This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
Keeping the conversation going.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
On The Conversation Hour today, arguably Australia's most influential and controversial intellectual exports, Peter Singer will join me. He's appeared in Melbourne this week talking about rejecting feel-good charities, is how he puts it. He has famously over decades said that doing good isn't enough. We need to know whether we're doing the most good. So, for instance, not donating locally to help one person get a guide dog. This is one of his examples. Not helping that one person get a guide dog, but instead using the same amount of money to save the sight of hundreds of people on the other side of the world. He says that's ethically better. How do you decide who to give money to? Is it to the right, to the person right in front of you? Or do you prefer to think of the greatest good, the greater good for the biggest number of people? Peter Singer will tell you the ethicist's calculus that he uses. But you tell me, how do you decide who to give to? Peter Singer will join me soon. Also today, should alcohol delivery drivers be responsible for assessing if you're too drunk at your door and refusing you the delivery? A few years ago, even though many of us don't know about this, laws were brought in that drivers don't just have to do the normal age verification, check your ID, but also they can't deliver to people who are intoxicated or appear to be intoxicated. So how does that work? Would you accept a driver saying, nope, you look too far gone, I'm taking this alcohol away? How is that even enforced? A study has found about 40% of us, Victorian consumers who were surveyed, received an alcohol delivery while intoxicated, despite these reforms. So I'd love to hear from you. Are you an alcohol delivery driver? Have you had this situation in front of you? Is this fair or even workable? Is it putting the onus on drivers too far? Is it ever going to work? Should they be the bartenders or even the bouncers on your doorstep? Also this hour, do you care if we're heading towards privately owned cricket teams in Australia, starting with the BBL? Because that's what they're saying. It's happening. So we've got Peter Singer and the privatisation of cricket. That's all coming up. But first, should alcohol delivery drivers be responsible for assessing who's drunk at the door?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
We will get to alcohol delivery drivers very soon. But Leonie, you want to talk about the privatisation of cricket clubs. What do you think?
I was just concerned about sports washing. I don't like the idea that clubs, you know, start selling off their businesses or their, you know, their what they do to privatised interests, because then someone has to police it to make sure it doesn't become corrupt, because we've seen examples overseas of clubs that are quite corrupt and they, you know, dirty money comes through those clubs and then they use as laundry. And we're seeing with what's happened with the LIV Golf, you know, like that's sort of gone west a bit now. So that was my concern, that it was just a risk of corruption and who's going to police it.
We do have... Leonie, we do have privatisation in other sports clubs and teams. Does it stand for you? We just shouldn't have it in sport at all?
Well, I just don't think we should have it in sport at all, personally. But, yeah, I guess that's my view.
Leonie,
I just think it's too much of a risk for corruption.
Yeah. Leonie, it's a really good thought, and we will get to that. I want to know if people agree with Leonie. Is we may have it in other sports as well, which is already the door ajar. Is it just one too far to have it be across cricket as well? I'd love to hear from you as we go through the conversation hour today on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. Chris, you deliver alcohol, is that right?
So I deliver shopping and alcohol on almost every day.
And sorry, Chris, sorry, I think I missed the beginning there. You deliver alcohol. Have you had to enforce that rule?
Well, no, I've never had any, but what I have to do is scan their ID on my smartphone, tick a box to say they're not intoxicated, and tick a box to say they are over 18.
And so have you ever encompassed... Sorry, Chris, keep going.
Sorry. No, I've never encountered this, but when I worked in hospitality and taught RSA, I've had to tell people who were too young they couldn't be served, but not when I've been dribbling alcohol at home, I haven't, no.
Have you ever looked at someone and thought, yeah, you're probably intoxicated, but I just can't have that confrontation? How am I going to do that?
I haven't, but I have smelt alcohol on someone's breath at 11 in the morning, and they were in their probably 50s. It's a bit. They weren't drunk, but they'd had a drink, and that's a bit different. But I'm in my mind, I'm going, I hope you don't have any more before you get another delivery.
So. Yes. Yeah, so, do it's you think that this law should be enforced, in or even?
Yes.
Yep.
I do, because the company, you know, I work for a gig company, and we have to enforce it. We have to scan their ID, tick a box to say they're not drunk, they're not under 18. So it's just part of the job.
So when would you refuse someone, Chris?
If they were intoxicated, if they were definitely under 18, for example, if they were
age
16,
is simple, but is intoxication
age,
as big
age
as
is
age?
The biggest one.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is, because I've never come across it, but you get a lot of, apparently, I've heard from other drivers, you get a lot of 16-year-olds grabbing their older brother or sister's license, and they look a little bit like them, and they try and pass themselves off.
Yeah, maybe age is a better or more contentious issue for you, Chris. Thank you. David, you're in Doncaster. What do you think?
I think that the drivers not having a RSA certificate, when they show up, if the person is intoxicated, they're being paid to deliver the alcohol. They're not the actual retailer. They're delivering the goods. And if they deem that the person is intoxicated and returns it back to the shop or back to the supplier, are they actually going to be paid for the trip and the return trip? Or are they just going to allow the alcohol to be delivered because they need the cash, because right. They know that there's going to be a lot of problems with what's going on. And it also puts them in danger if they do have someone that's intoxicated and they refuse to hand it over. Anything could happen on the doorstep, being attacked and stuff like that. So it's also a safety issue.
Yeah, that's right. So you don't think that this can ever really be enforced, this reform?
No, yeah. Because there's too many variables. And as the previous caller stated, people using their older brother's licenses and stuff like that because they look similar. And if they refuse to deliver to someone that's intoxicated, you see it in the pubs when they get aggravated and stuff like that. They'll just attack the driver and take the alcohol anyway.
Yeah. David, thank you for that. And Andrew, you wanted to say something?
Hi there, Mary. Does a driver who doesn't complete a delivery because they shouldn't still get paid for attempting that delivery?
For you, that's, apart from anything else, you think that might be a reason why they would tick that box?
I would think so. If they don't get paid, then they've wasted their time doing that. It's almost like they need to get paid double if they've refused, because chances are it's probably not a pleasant situation. I also wonder, why is someone ordering home delivery of alcohol if they're not capable of driving to go and get it? So where does this all balance?
Where does it all balance? Andrew, thank you. And I'm getting many texts as well saying just ban those deliveries altogether. This is all sparked by a new report from Monash University and Turning Point that surveyed some Victorian consumers, found that 4 in 10, 40%, had received an alcohol delivery while intoxicated, and looked at, apart from anything else, this particular requirement for drivers to be the ones to tick off on people being intoxicated or not. Joining me now from Turning Point and Monash University is Associate Professor Bosco Rowland, who's a statistician and one of the research fellows there. Thanks for joining us, Bosco.
Pleasure.
You heard everyone talk there. This really does echo what you found, that most consumers were unaware of this particular reform, and when they did find out, they were sort of supportive, but they were pretty sceptical about enforcement.
Yes, I think there's an intuitive sense that people recognise that we need to manage this space, and that that alcohol is an addictive and toxic substance, and, you know, when drink drunk at high levels, people who could behaviour changes. And so we need to have strategies that sort of manage that. So people generally supportive of the reforms, but they recognise, yes, they are being implemented to some degree, but we really can't see how they're really going to be truly enforced and compliance really checked.
We're talking about the onus on alcohol delivery drivers. Do you think that that is fair, that they need to judge whether someone's intoxicated or not? Just I've been told that Chris called back. He is a driver and he does answer the question, I think from Andrew, would he get paid for the job? Yes, if he had to take alcohol back. But Bosco Rowland, you've looked at this as part of the whole scene to be looking at more the health aspects of people who are still drinking at home and so forth. This requirement to have the drivers be the bouncers, if you like, at the doorstep, how much does that, what part do you think that plays in the problems that you're seeing in terms of health?
Look, I think it's a major problem because, you know, we've spent years and years trying to get strategies right and harm reduction strategies and preventative strategies in places like hotels and bars. So we've got things like RSA training for the bars, and I heard some of your callers talk about that, and that means responsible alcohol management training. So they learn to recognise signs of intoxication, how to refuse service, all those sorts of things, security checks, all that sort of stuff. But in a bar, you've got your staff around you, you've got colleagues to support you. You don't have the same safety structure around you within a home delivery context. So we're putting someone in a position as a bartender or a bar server and not training them with the appropriate skills. Mm. And at the same time, there are no limits on what can be said. And so we've been promoting strategies around safe consumption, limits of consumption, but there are no limits around what can be delivered.
Bosco Rowland is with you. He's from Monash University in Turning Point, and we are talking about it from a health point of view through that lens in your survey, Bosco. But have a listen to this on text. It's not illegal to drink alcohol. Does it mean that postal workers and delivery drivers would need an RSA as well? I'm a delivery driver for AusPost and I regularly deliver alcohol, especially wine, to doctors. But this is the first time I've heard about not delivering to drunk people. That's interesting when you're a driver for Australia Post. How do you justify then that law to not only make the drivers bear the brunt of it, but to even have that law?
Yeah, look, it's a whole frontier that's opened up since COVID. So when COVID started, you know, alcohol home delivery really surged, and then all of a sudden we're faced with these problems around, you know, who do we deliver to? Is it safe to deliver? What time can we deliver? How much can we deliver? And so we're sort of playing catch up. And so, you know, you can get alcohol delivered as part of a delivery just focusing on alcohol. You can get alcohol delivered as part of a food delivery, or you can get alcohol delivered part of your shopping. So each of those are a different context, and often one context won't be the same. But as one of your earlier callers mentioned, that people sometimes order alcohol because they're already intoxicated, they don't want to drive, but they want to keep consuming. So there's all these problems, and no single point or method of delivery will have the same solution. But we need to find ways to manage this because it's really running out of control.
What would you like to see?
Well, I'd like to see, certainly at the point of sale, checks and balances around people recognising the reforms and recognising that they aren't allowed to be sold alcohol if they're intoxicated. So that will then slightly buffer the experience for the driver. I think also, you know, we shouldn't be promoting alcohol on those websites to be delivered and giving delivery fees and discounts. We should be, in terms of, like, when we sell a product that is harmful, we should be advising the public that this is harmful. So if there is home delivery, we should be sending them the safe drinking standards on what they should be drinking and what would be permitted as safe standard in a day and in a week.
Are you suggesting that you put a little flyer in that, you know, sort of a health guide as you're delivering the alcohol?
A little box on the low-risk drinking guidelines. How many times have you had a delivery when you've got a box and some other card saying, here's a voucher for this or here's a voucher for that? So it's not not an irregular suggestion. Most people would be expecting that. I think it's just a way of creating by osmosis and by gradual influence the standards of drinking and what's expected or what would be good for your health or better for your health.
Bosco, I think this has educated a lot of people, apart from anything else, about reforms that were brought in 2022. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's Associate Professor Bosco Rowland, who is statistician, senior research fellow at Turning Point and Monash University. Lots of texts coming in about this. I'd like to remain anonymous, says this texter, but it happens all the time. I deliver in the gig economy and people reek of alcohol oftentimes. And like this guy says, deliveries in the morning or through the day. I had a lady just last night, says this texter, with an expired ID. So I couldn't complete the order and she said, call your boss and snatch the alcohol off me. It's pretty vexed. Wow. This Uber does pay you for the trip and to return it to the store, but there's no way I would ever refuse delivering it. It would be extremely dangerous. Mike, you're in Springvale. What did you want to say?
My question is, would you do the same if you were delivering a pizza and the man opens the door and he's obviously very obese and the pizza is not good for him health-wise? Would you give it to him? Would you take it away?
Right. And what do you think that if a little flyer talking about, you know, how to be healthy was attached to the pizza?
Yeah, no, that's good. Like on cigarette covers, you know, you have a saying this is harmful or something like that. Also, it's safer to be at home and drinking if you must than driving. Yeah. That's my other point. But, you know, I think the advertising saying it's a health risk is a good idea, but not putting people in a position where they have to drive and get their own drink.
Yeah.
Maybe get caught and cause an accident and so on.
Yep.
Much safer at home.
Mike, thank you. That's what Mike is thinking. What do you think? 1300 222 774. Lots of calls to just ban the alcohol delivery. Don't put the onus on the drivers. We didn't need it before this delivery. Why do we need it now? Other suggestions to limit deliveries between 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Obviously, there are many different curfews as well across states when it comes to these deliveries. So it's not as if we have all of our ducks in a row when it comes to a united health effort against this. Someone who has a speech defect or aftermath of a stroke, etc., who are otherwise disabled, can't get to the shops themselves. How do you determine if they are intoxicated? How can a delivery driver be expected to discern the difference? Yes, so much. Julie from Northcote says, it's crazy. Let's just stop the delivery of booze by fast delivery companies, not to say Australia Post, Dan's and the like. What do you think? We will continue this conversation as we go through the conversation hour and a little later as well. What do you think about the privatisation of cricket? It is on its way. But also on his way is Peter Singer. He's in Melbourne this week talking about effective altruism, as he often does. We're going to be talking about how we decide who to give money to. I'd love to know, how do you decide who to give money to? Is it the person right in front of you? Or do you think it's morally better to think of the greatest good for the biggest number of people, even if they're not right in front of you, even if they're on the other side of the world?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Joining me now is Peter Singer. You know him, philosopher, bioethicist, author of Animal Liberation and The Life You Can Save. He's been in Melbourne for a discussion about how philanthropy can achieve measurable impact just at this time when global health funding is being slashed. Peter Singer, thank you so much for joining the Conversation Hour. Let's start with what you've been doing in Melbourne this week. You had a night in conversation alongside Asif Saleh, who's himself a major figure in philanthropy. You talk about rejecting donating what you call feel-good charities. What's your definition of that, and why shouldn't we donate to them?
Well, we certainly should be donating to charities, and particularly, of course, it's the end of the financial year. This is a time a lot of people donate. but I want them to donate to the charities that have a proven record of getting essentially the best value out of your donation. We don't want to donate just to feel good ourselves. That's what I'm talking about. We want to donate to do the most good we can. And of course, we all have limited resources. So it's good to know that somebody has been independently checking the organization that you're donating to and has just, you know, found out that that organization is going to get great value out of what you donate. It's going to help children who would have otherwise died, maybe not reached their fifth birthday, is going to stop people getting serious disabilities or diseases that are going to damage their lives. And that's what the Life You Can Save does. We recommend charities on our website, thelifeyoucansave.org.au, and you can be confident that you'll be getting good value from them.
I think everyone listening would agree you need to have good value. You need to not have the wasted administrative fees and so forth. But you have also argued in a bit of a bigger picture that you don't necessarily help the person right in front of you if with that same amount of money you can save more people even if you've never met them. I'm going to put something to you. We're conducting Meals for Melbourne here at 774. It's an old-fashioned food drive. We did that because we had a caller, John, calling up to Raf Epstein's program who said he hadn't eaten for 3 days. We picked that up. We're running with it. We're now working with Food Bank to help other people in John's position. How does that fit in the effective altruism frame? Are we being ethically wrong or sloppy?
Well, I mean, I think it's fine to do a certain amount in your local community, and there is some need in our local community. I won't deny that. But generally speaking, Australians are very lucky compared to people elsewhere in the world. I mean, we all have safe drinking water. That's not a problem. We don't have to walk for 3 or 4 kilometres and to get water and then carry it back. We can educate our children free. We have a healthcare system that can will provide us with free healthcare. There are so many people in the world that don't have those things. And, you know, in a way, I think that is more basic and you actually get better value because in Australia, I don't know why the person who called contacted you had not eaten for 3 days, but, you know, you can get social security, you can get assistance. We have that system, and so many people don't. And at the moment, the overseas aid that was going to them, particularly from the United States, has been slashed. So the need to help people in low-income countries is, unfortunately, greater than ever.
I guess John's case really is the counter-argument to what you're saying, Peter Singer, because, yes, in theory, you can look at us, and of course we're lucky, and of course we have the systems. But John didn't know that. John fell through the cracks. Others fall through the cracks. We've got people here texting in saying, look, charity begins at home. That's a non-philosopher's reaction. What do you say to that?
I don't think charity begins at home if you're living in a country that is so much more affluent than other parts of the world. I mean, the World Bank has a line for people who are regarded as being in extreme poverty. That's $3 per day. Let's say, if you like, $5 per day. Now, just imagine if somebody is on that and you were to give them like $100. That makes a huge difference to their lives because they can now buy things that they could never think of buying before, maybe things that in the long run will save them money. And, you know, but in Australia, if you give people $100, it's not going to last long. It's not going to make a life-transforming difference to them. So that's why I think we ought to be looking at the world as a whole. We ought not just be looking in our own backyard.
Yeah, but you're listening to Peter Singer, of course, a well-known ethicist. TheLifeYouCanSave.org.au is his platform as well that can help make decisions about giving. You say that $100 in Australia, obviously, relatively speaking, comparing countries, is not a lot. But we are living in times of cost of living crises, existential crises with climate change, geopolitical crises, financial crises across the world. Yes, these times do come and go. But right now in 2026, is this a particularly tough time to sell the art of giving? $100 is a lot to a lot of Australians.
Well, it's also not a lot to a lot of Australians, you know, be honest. I mean, people go out to dinner and they spend $100 at a restaurant. If they want to go to a concert, they're spending maybe multiple hundreds of dollars on the evening out. So I'm not talking to people for whom $100 is a lot of money. If you really cannot provide for your basic needs, I'm not quite sure why, but whatever the reason might be, if you can't find, you know, I'm talking to people who think nothing of spending $100 on a night out, and maybe spend thousands of dollars on a holiday. And, you know, and I'm not condemning that either, because I think we all spend things on ourselves, and that's reasonable. And you might want to spend something on your local community, but I'm suggesting you ought to put aside something for where it will do the most good worldwide.
Mm.
And as I say, I think there are a lot of Australians who can quite comfortably afford that, and there's no great sacrifice. And in fact, in a way, their lives may go better for knowing that they're really making a positive difference to the world.
Mm. You have consistently over decades talked about this idea that people can give up the luxuries of life, and you've in fact highlighted young people, old people who at a certain point in their lives say, look, I don't need all of this, and give up part of their salary and so forth. On a personal note, what luxuries did you give up or give up first or decide were the things that you could carve away from your own life?
Well, I think that there are, you know, I don't like going to expensive restaurants. I do go out sometimes, but I think you can enjoy food at low-cost restaurants. I don't spend a lot of money on things like concerts, so on. That would be very rare if I were to go to something like that.
Was it a decision? Is it a convenient decision, if you like, then, if you don't actually like it?
Look, yes, in a way. I mean, these are things that I think I would say I educate my taste so that they don't go to things which are expensive. And really don't give me that much benefit, I feel. I mean, I know some of my friends spend a lot of money on fine wines. I'm not really interested in that either. I think there are much more satisfying things to do with your money, including knowing that you're making a difference to the lives of other people who would never dream of being able to go to the kinds of restaurants that my friends and I might go to quite routinely.
Mm. You're listening to Peter Singer. We are talking about giving. Tell me how you decide how you give. Peter Singer, I guess also just in terms of the times we are living in, we're living in a time where social norms, even displays of morality from leadership figures, is on the wane, some would argue. We've got tolerance of corruption across the world. A lot of people are turning away from the news. Do you feel, even if it's not the right time financially for people, do you fear that this noise is so overwhelming that people are turning away from giving, from philanthropy?
I know that there are some organisations who are feeling the pinch, that they are not getting the donations they did before. But, you know, it's a diverse community, and I know there are lots of people who also, for whom giving is an important part of what they do. It's something that gives them satisfaction and gives meaning and purpose to their lives. And so I think we should be encouraging that. I think that makes for a better society than one where people are spending a lot of time on consumption, or for that matter, a lot of time on their screens when they could be many more useful things that they're doing and more meaningful things that would actually bring them a better life.
Do you think enough very rich people are giving away enough?
No, they're certainly not. I'm trying to encourage them to give more. I'm also trying to encourage companies to give more. I've now co-founded an organization called the Profit for Good Alliance. We're looking for companies to pledge to give at least 10% of their profits to effective charities. And you know, we have some wonderful companies in Australia that are actually giving like 100%, like Humanitix, the ticketing agency, where 100% of their profits go to some of the causes that I've been talking about, helping people in low-income countries, saving the lives of children who might otherwise not see their fifth birthday. Or who gives a crap, the toilet paper company, where 50% of their profits go to good causes, to sanitation, in fact, appropriately enough. Mm. So I think there are people who do this, and it's wonderful, and I think we should know more about them. I think we should talk more about what they're doing, and we should regard them as the people we follow and want to talk about on social media more than some of the shallow celebrities that we have.
Mm. This on text from Karen from Hyatt. She wants to ask about the size of the organisation that you might be donating to, not just the distance. Aren't some of the overseas organisations huge, soaking up the donation? I guess that's what comes down to the analysis that we each have to make as to where the money goes. Bigger bang for buck.
Well, as I said, thelifeyoucansave.org.au will give you information about how effective organisations are. And some of the organisations we're recommending are quite small. The Against Malaria Foundation, for example, which distributes bed nets to children in, to families in areas where malaria is a major killer of children, started out with basically one person. It's now got a few more because fortunately it has grown, but it's still a small and lean organisation, and so are many of the other organisations that we're doing. They're quite simple things that you can do. You can add essential nutrients to flour, for example, which an organisation called Sanku does that prevents diseases of malnutrition in parts of Africa where otherwise people would not get this sort of fortified flour. Yeah. That they're consuming. So some of these are very simple. They're often one-purpose organisations. It's more difficult to actually evaluate the really big organisations that do dozens of different things. Mm. So we look for ones where we can clearly evaluate how much good the program is doing and how much it costs per life saved or per life improved or, you know, injuries avoided, whatever it might be.
Mm. You're listening to Peter Singer. We're talking about how we choose to donate. I'd love to hear how you choose to donate as well. Peter Singer, I've always thought that with decades and decades of being a moral philosopher, that really sets you up as well as a little bit of a target for how you conduct your life. You've said publicly that you haven't lived up to the highest standards that your philosophy implies. Does being a moral philosopher make life harder?
I think it makes life a lot more interesting. I think it gives you, as I say, this feeling that you're making a difference, at least if you're the kind of moral philosopher that tries to affect the behaviour of people in the world outside the universities, as I am. Yes, it's true that, you know, people have standards. A few years ago, I got a $1 million US dollar prize called the Berggruen Prize for Philosophy and Culture, and I gave it all away to the causes I'm talking about. And somebody said to me, well, you'd sort of, you know, set your own trap for that one, hadn't you? Because you couldn't really do anything else with it. And in a sense, that's true. You know, I was, at that time, I was a professor at Princeton University. I've since retired from that. So I was on a good professorial salary. And, you know, I certainly didn't need this $1 million. And I could see that it could do a lot of good donated to effective organisations. So, yes, I mean,
maybe being a successful moral philosopher is hard.
A successful moral philosopher. I think, you know, I'm delighted with the fact that people have responded to the things that I write about. The Life You Can Save was set up about 2012, I think, so 15 years ago or something like that. And we've received $140 million in that period. I wish it were $140 billion. It could all be used for good purposes, but I'm pretty satisfied that I've encouraged people to give to effective charities a lot more than I could have, even if I'd given, you know, 100% of what I'm earning. I could never have got to those sort of figures.
After so long in this space and across so many different waves of thinking on so many ethical issues, are there questions that you once thought were settled in your own mind that now seem much more complicated?
Well, I think actually in global politics has unfortunately gone in a poor direction. I thought that it was settled that there's such a thing as international law, that we ought to obey that we ought to try to work through the United Nations and build international organisations to try to bring about a more peaceful world. And, you know, in the last sort of say 4 years since Russia invaded Ukraine started things, but then more recently we've seen the Trump administration has also violated the UN Charter through its intervention in Venezuela and even more so in Iran now. I did take it for granted that we were trying to achieve a world of international law rather than a kind of might makes right world. And things, unfortunately, have not gone in the right direction in the last few years.
Well, and also many people argue that the moral tone comes from leadership. Are you worried in that sense that we're heading towards overall a less ethical world?
Well, that varies between the different countries that you're looking at and living in. But yes, obviously the leaders of major nations, that does have an influence. And so the US president is occupying a lot of airspace and soaking up a lot of media. And so a lot of people are getting this idea that although he says he has a morality, it's not easy to work out what that might be. So people get the idea that it's not important or it doesn't matter.
Yeah. You've been listening to Peter Singer, of course, world-famous ethicist. And I've been talking a lot about how long you've been in the game. And I'm sorry if that's rude, Peter. You're actually, if you don't mind me saying, turning 80 next month. What are you going to do? What's an ethical birthday party?
Well, I am taking a bit of a holiday with the family.
A holiday? Aren't you supposed to give that up?
we're staying within Australia. We're not flying overseas, but we're going up north a bit, I must admit. So that's a bit of an indulgence, I agree. I'd never said I was a saint, but it will be good to be spending time with the children and grandchildren.
I guess.
And my wife, of course.
Yeah, and I guess underlining all of that, what does keep you going? You are 80. You've been fighting many fights, some of which you've brought on yourself, but what does keep you going?
I think it's the sense of satisfaction that you can achieve things, even if, whatever the direction the world is going in, you can make things better for some people. Also, I've been concerned about animal welfare, as you mentioned. I can try to make factory farming less popular than it is, unfortunately, persuade more people to not buy the products of factory farming, which treats animals so badly. So I feel, there's progress to be made in those areas. We've got nearly as far as I would have liked, but I think maybe I've helped to get a little bit further than we otherwise would have, and that's what keeps me going.
Peter Singer, really great to talk with you, and thank you for giving your time this morning.
Thanks so much, Mary. Good to talk to you.
That's Peter Singer. Thelifeyoucansave.org.au is where you can go to look at the platform that Peter was talking about. And also, he's on a podcast. It's called Lives Well Lived. So many voices saying Peter Singer is a brave person, a longtime hero of mine since animal liberation, says Annie. People are agreeing with Peter Singer about a woman complaining about the cost of living, but she had hair lights and Botox, so it's a problem of priorities. But this from Carol, this guy is so judgmental, head in the clouds. He mentions his friends and how they spend their money on things he doesn't like, so I can't relate to him. And others saying, I agree with Peter Singer, but I do both, donating both home and abroad. I give to Médecins Sans Frontières and the Fred Hollows Foundation and hospitals, etc. Others saying, thank you for calling out Australia's collective selfishness. Tell me what you thought of Peter Singer and how you also do choose how to give. I'd love for that conversation to keep going. But coming up next, what do you think of the privatisation of cricket? It hasn't happened so far. Well, now we learn that it's on the way.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, you might have woken to the news that only broke very late yesterday that Cricket Victoria is going to kill off the two BBL teams that it has, merge them into one under a state banner, but the second BBL licence that's owned by Cricket Victoria will be sold in its entirety to a private investor. On Mornings, talking to Raf Epstein was Nick Cummins, who's Cricket Victoria's CEO, and he was saying, well, look, this has been around for a while, this idea.
It's sort of been widely publicised, Cricket Australia's desire to have public and private investment into the Big Bash. So we made the decision some time ago, if we were going to go down this path, we would sell 100% of one team and retain the other.
So well publicised, he says. Is it a surprise, though, to you? Tell me what you think. 1300 222 774. Do you want to see privatisation of cricket, even if it starts with the BBL? Yes, that heathen code there. Daniel Brettig is going to break it all down for us. He is author and chief cricket writer for The Age. Hi, Daniel.
Good to be with you, Mary.
What did you think about the decision? Did it shock you?
It didn't shock me in the sense that we knew that Cricket Victoria were the state currently keenest to get moving on this in terms of privatisation. The shock is more that this decision has been relayed to the Cricket Victoria staff and eventually to the players as a fait accompli, that the brands are going to be retired, that one team is definitely going to be sold off and the other team will be kind of aggregated into a Victoria style team with the old Big V type logo and the blue and the white. The surprise about that is it can't be a fait accompli because the other states around Australia, of which there are sort of two other states, WA and Tasmania, who are keen to sell, and three other states, New South Wales, Queensland and South Australia, who are not so keen to sell, they haven't reached agreement on this yet. And they have to do that in order for this process to continue. So it's opened a bit of a fault line between the states who want to sell, the states who don't want to sell, and also Cricket Australia, who are kind of in the middle of all of this trying to manage the process.
So what do you think this move means then? Do you think that it's Cricket Victoria essentially forcing the issue?
I think that's a big part of it, yes. Mm. My understanding of it is they were ready to put, you know, the what is now currently the Melbourne Renegades license out to market in February this year, and were frustrated by the fact that there wasn't consensus around the country about doing so and following the sort of the plans that Cricket Australia had wanted to put in place. And so now, yeah, they're moving ahead of the rest of the group, and that's caused a lot of shock around the country last night and this morning.
Mm. Tell me, if you're listening, are you shocked? Apparently, this is old news, but are you shocked and are you upset about the privatisation of cricket? 1300 222 774. Or is this the way it's all going? And if things aren't sustainable, that's just the answer. Let me know what you think. Daniel Brettig is breaking it down for us. He is from The Age and has written about this for quite some time. Daniel, you've got the ear to the wall behind closed doors. You talk about this rift between the states. Is the nature of the split anti-privatisation and pro-privatisation, or is it just about the degree or the manner in which the privatisation is going to take place?
I think at its simplest form, it probably is, those who are true believers in selling stakes in big bash clubs and those who are sceptical about it. And if you're sceptical about something, that doesn't mean you'll never do it, but it might mean you don't want to do it now. Mm-hmm. I'd say that'd be the way that the split has evolved. And it's also a split based on different states looking at the financial forecast numbers that Cricket Australia have presented to the states in the past 6 to 9 months in different ways. Some are looking at those numbers and seeing great growth and upside. Others are looking at those numbers in the way that Cricket Victoria have looked at those numbers and said, well, we see a growing a hole here of potentially hundreds of millions of dollars, meaning that we think now is the time to sell.
Mm. And I guess we are pure when it comes to privatisation in cricket here, but that's not the case elsewhere anyway, is it?
Yeah, well, Cricket Australia and the Australian cricket system is really the last major cricket board, cricket nation that doesn't have privatised teams in their T20 league. England Cricket Board were the last major country to go that way last year with their competition, the 100, and just across the Tasman in recent months, New Zealand Cricket have decided that they are going to go to a city-based franchise model as a departure from what they've previously done. So it is happening around the world. The thing that's tricky about Australian cricket, as everyone knows, is the Big Bash League and the Australian Summer of Test Cricket, they happen at the same time. So the question is, if you move to a model of privatising the clubs, how are you going to continue to have this kind of intricate system where there's a Boxing Day test at the MCG and a New Year's test at the Sydney Cricket Ground, and then in the evening, each night of those matches, there are Big Bash games going on around the rest of the country. How does that work if you've got private owners saying, well, we would like the best players who are currently playing in a test match to be playing for our Big Bash team tonight?
Exactly. How do you carve that away when it's all just been between state associations and so forth? And that's already been fraught, freeing up people for the test game. I mean, that does lead to the question, is this the thin end of the wedge? Can you, you know, we couldn't possibly be talking about privatisation of the test team. Goodness. But what about anything in between? The one-day internationals, Sheffield Shield?
I think the state of play with this really is there are private investors who want to invest in franchise leagues, T20 leagues around the world. Mm-hmm. Then you have cricket boards whose responsibilities go far beyond simply putting on profitable sort of high-end cricket matches, to community cricket, to grassroots, to junior cricket, to also the high-performance pathways for the test and white ball international sides. So there's a bit of a tension there. And also culturally, Australia is different to a lot of other countries where we have a huge amount of privatisation. If you think of the United States, for example, they have a thriving privately owned professional sporting ecosystem. They have a thriving high school sport ecosystem and a thriving college ecosystem, but they don't have the kind of club-based, volunteer-based pathways to anywhere near the same extent that we have in Australia, and we see as normal, you know, going to play for your club team in whether it's in cricket or footy or rugby league or union on a weekend. It's a very different model. So there's complexities all the way through, and that's where Cricket Victoria's move today has been seen as quite dramatic.
Watch this space, Daniel Bredig. Thank you so much for joining us today.
No worries, Mary.
Daniel Bredig is chief cricket writer for The Age and author as well. Andrew has pointed out, yeah, we have flirted with privatisation before, pointing to the Packer tests as well. On 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria, it's been a big conversation hour. We've been talking about cricket. We also earlier were talking about the onus on delivery drivers of alcohol, delivering alcohol, to refuse people the delivery if they appear to be intoxicated. Shane, you've called from Lara. What would you like to say?
Yeah, hi, Mary. One of the things that I find very confusing about this delivery thing is that there's no onus on these delivery drivers. So, for instance, each retailer has a liquor licence with conditions they must comply with. Each staff member also has to have a responsible service of alcohol accreditation. So why would the delivery driver even know what the liquor license says, and if they don't do RSA? So these companies should be sending their own employees out, because the bottom line is, if they breach that liquor license, they don't sell alcohol. So put it back to them.
Mm. And Shane, you're a former police officer, is that right?
Yes, I am.
How do you regard that potential situation? A delivery driver, even with an RSA, turning up on someone's doorstep saying, oh, no, actually, I'm going to turn around and take this away from you.
I don't see it as anything that's going to protect their employment or their safety. So, for instance, these retailers have all their cameras. They have multiple staff members, as do most licensed premises. I don't see why these people have any responsibility about what that liquor license says. No.
Even though those reforms in 2022 actually gave it to them. Shane, I don't think we're going to hear the last of this issue. So many safety issues around people in the gig economy. Thank you so much for joining me on the Conversation Hour. Still getting texts in about Peter Singer saying, I feel great that Australia has a social welfare system, but I feel his comments highlighted he's never had to try to live on them. But someone else who says, we downsize to a house with one bathroom or laundry. We don't eat at restaurants. We're content. We live on a pension and we feel very lucky. So many great calls and texts. Thank you. It's been an hour of a lot of opinions and a lot of nuance as well. Let's continue that tomorrow on the Conversation Hour. You can listen to it all again on the ABC Listen app and write to me, conversationhour@abc.net.au.